You're tuning in to the Designer's Inner Circle podcast, hosted by The Circle, the number one design blog by designers for designers. Hello, and welcome back to the Designer's Inner Circle podcast, made by freelancers for freelancers. I'm your host, Ellen Yang, and each week we sit down with some of the hottest influencers in the design and marketing community and talk about all things design, UX, business, and anything else related or in between. So this week we have a really exciting guest. I'm sure many of you guys already know him, Michael Janda, aka More Janda on Instagram. We're so excited to sit down with him here today and talk more about, you know, how to go from building your first agency and getting your first clients to working with global brands like NBC, Fox, and this amazing list of clients that Michael has gotten over the years. So I'll let Michael introduce himself further, and then we can hop into the questions and explore a lot of the things that our community has been waiting to ask him.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you, Ellen. It's so fun. This one happened fast. Like, you messaged me, what, like two weeks ago or something, and now we're on already. So I'm super grateful. I've been following The Circle for a long time and connected with several of the people that are involved there, and just a great community. You guys have a big community, which is awesome. So yeah, if you don't know me, my name is Michael Janda. I've been doing creative services for 24 years now already. I was a creative director at Fox Studios for a few years, about 20 years ago, and then I started an agency, grew my agency over 13 years and sold it. I've written some books, Burn Your Portfolio and The Psychology of Graphic Design Pricing, and I've had a fun career doing things that I love to do for brands that are exciting and fun to work with, and every once in a while, I kind of pinch myself at the journey that I've had, that it's been so great. It exceeded every dream that I ever had when I started out my career as a designer.
That's amazing. I'm so glad to hear that. And I know that you're a huge inspiration for a lot of people in our community. And again, we're so blessed to have you here and learn more about, you know, your career, but not, and just like going beyond that, you know, just business tips you have for other people who were in your position back in 2002, 2003, and so on. So I guess we'll start with our first question here today, which is kind of going back to what you were mentioning earlier, but what empowered you to start your agency, and were there any early resources that you used to launch it successfully?
So starting my agency came out of necessity. It was in 2000, I landed a job as a creative director at Fox Studios. So I moved from Phoenix to Los Angeles and started working at Fox. And I thought, oh man, this is going to be great. I'm a director level position. I'm going to stay here for the next 20 years and retire from Fox. This is going to be great. My dream come true, work in Hollywood and have, you know, window office overlooking the Fox lot. This was my life. And then September 11th happened, and then the dot-com bubble burst and the economy went into some turmoil, and Fox decided to sell off our assets to Disney. So Fox Kids and Fox Family were sold to Disney, and Disney started down the process of dismantling the team over a year and a half of time. And during that time, I was looking for jobs. I was never more qualified than I was then, but I couldn't get a job because people weren't hiring. This was an economic downturn, and people were tightening their teams. A friend of mine worked at ABC.com, and they had 50 people, went down to like five or six people during that era. Our team at Fox, we were 50-something people, and we were six on the last day. So I was enduring this, and I couldn't get a job, but some of my friends who were marketing managers, producers, account managers, started landing at other companies in Hollywood and started sending me freelance work because they didn't have internal teams. So that's what launched me into freelance. It was out of no other option. I never sat back and said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a freelancer and I'm going to build an agency. I didn't do that until probably 3 years into freelancing full-time during the first year, I was still sitting there thinking, I'm going to have to go get a job. It's time. It's been 3 months and now I have a week where I don't have any work. Oh no, I've got to go get a job. This was my mindset for a long time. And I changed that over time and started to kind of go for it. And once I did that, everything started to grow.
Okay. That's pretty awesome, actually. I feel like when it comes to freelancing, there is really just there's like different stories for every person, but, I think your story kind of goes to show how the culture of freelancing has changed a lot, because I feel like nowadays, like people who are in freelancing now are just like, it's because they've been really empowered to start one. And I'm done with the 9-to-5. Like, I had this job, I'm leaving this job. And yeah. I can do this too. But you know, your story is sort of the other side of that, where it's just like, I needed a job and I had to start with freelancing work. So. Yeah.
Well, we live in something now that didn't exist when I started freelancing, and it's the gig economy. We're in the gig economy where people are working gigs, not the full-time job thing. The era of people getting a job at a company and working there for 30 years or 40 years and retiring from that company, that's all but gone. But that was my dad. You know, my dad's generation was the get your job and build yourself up in a career and stay at the company for 30 years. And a lot of the people's parents of the gig economy era that we're in, that was their life. It was this career in one company thing. But that's gone away. We have such entrepreneurial young people that do want to go and be their own boss and work their own hours. And now, because of technology, it's actually feasible to do that. You can, you can be on an island in Thailand and still run your freelance business.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point you brought up, because your career is actually older than I am, and I can't.
Sad. Don't bring that up to me. That's sad.
No, I think that's really awesome. Like, I think what makes this community so great is that I like can't imagine a world where I don't have the resources to just like randomly, you know, start an account for a business that I wanted to pursue or anything. And then I feel like this community has been especially welcoming and fostering this like freelance. Freelancing is for everyone. I think that's like the current thing that is really popular in the community. And that's definitely something that the Circle has been trying to manifest within our community. So I guess this relates to what you're just talking about, but you know, prior to founding Riser, what experiences, both professional and not, kind of prepared you to actually create this agency, even if it was out of necessity?
A lot of my career kind of came out of necessity. When I first took my very first job, it was because it was at a copy store. So I graduated with my design degree, and couldn't get a job anywhere because my portfolio sucked. And I ended up getting a job as like a pre-press guy at production house for a little copy center. And that was my first job. And that experience is what really fueled me career-wise to say, you know what? I'm better than this. This isn't going to be my life. I'm not going to just settle for a copy center job. I'm better than this. And it drove me and inspired me and motivated me to go after, to create a dream. And to go after it, learn what I needed to learn to make it happen. So I bounced around a few starter jobs, had a great opportunity in Phoenix where I was a creative director for a children's online world. And we were building this thing in Flash, and it was revolutionary. It was 1998, so it was before anybody was doing anything like this. But we were building all kinds of online games, this whole cast of characters, online cartoons and things. And they were raising a bunch of money. And so I had that experience. That's what got me my job at Fox, because what we were doing at this company was so innovative. It was able to land me a job at Fox. And then that kind of is what launched me into the relationships that became my agency later on.
Wow. I definitely think that story speaks to a lot of how people get started, because I think, especially when we think about the kind of economy that's going to be present when a lot of current college students graduate, I don't think it's going to be that much different from the one that you were just talking about, you know, where people are going to, you know, people with these degrees are going to be in copy stores. And hopefully we'll see like an entrepreneurial burst after that.
Yeah.
So when did you start, you know, working with bigger name clients like NBC and Google, and what kind of process was that like, and how did that actually end up happening?
Well, so I mentioned that a little bit at the start. I had some coworkers at Fox that were my friends. They were in the marketing department, and one of them got a job at Disney. One went to Warner Brothers. One went to Sony, and they started sending me freelance work just because they were friends. It was relationships, and I hammer on relationships all the time in my content because I built my whole agency on relationships. So I started with these three or four different friends who were account manager, marketing managers, and they started sending me work. And over time, I got to know their new coworker who was managing some other brands inside of Disney. And I started doing work for that person. And then one of the people left Disney and went to TV Guide. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to lose all that work from that person. But all of a sudden the phone rings and I start getting work from TV Guide. And then a friend of mine who left Fox, went to AOL, which was big back in the day. And he started sending me work. And then he moved up the chain and got a job at NBC in Rockefeller Center and started sending me tons of work from NBC. So again, it's a chain of referrals. And I tell people sometimes you've got to stay in the game long enough till these referrals start happening, because you start with 1, 2, 3 clients, and it may take you a year to turn your 3 clients into 4 clients. And then it might take you another year to turn your 4 clients into 6 clients. And then all of a sudden in year 3, your 6 clients turn into 18 clients. And your 18 clients the next year turn into 30 clients. And this growth is exponential that happens. But it's such a relationship-based game, the creative services thing. People buy because they trust you, they like you, they want to work with you. They buy because they were referred by somebody they trust. So they say, hey, go talk to Ellen. She's a great designer. And that referral, that one statement, is why you get the client. And so much, the best clients come from that. They come from people you know, and you got to stay in the game long enough to let that organically grow over time, which it will, if you can retain the relationships you have and let them expand.
Yeah. So I think a common thing that we hear a lot from people, you know, who interact within the circle is that, you know, they've kind of plateaued where they feel like they are in the game and they've been in the game, but you know, they're not getting that kind of relationship referral system. So is there any way to really get out of that? Or is that, you know, usually because you're just not doing it correctly or something else?
If you do good work and you are good to work with, you will get referrals over time. If you do good work and you are good to work with and you ask your clients for referrals, you'll get them even faster. So this is the problem that a lot of designers have, is they sometimes just wait organically for this to happen. And you can turn it in, you can make your own catalyst for growth by sitting, it's funny, I say take your clients to lunch. I say it all the time. It's like one of the mantras in the BizBuds podcast is, take your clients to lunch, and you sit down with your client and you talk about real things. And then at the end of the lunch, you say, hey, do you know anybody else who might need services like what we have to offer? And if your client likes you and appreciates the quality of work that you produce, that question is not awkward. That question is just you asking your friend who you just spent an hour at lunch with, if they know anybody who might need your services, and you plant that seed inside of their brain. And now they go back to their meetings in the afternoon and they have a coworker in the meeting say, oh, who should we have design that for us? And all of a sudden, spark, they think, wait a second, I just had lunch with Ellen. And she said, do I know anybody who needs design work? And now somebody's asking for design work. And then they say, hey, you know, my friend Ellen, who's done some work for us, she'd be great. I'll put you in touch with her. That's how you can make it happen. But you got to open your mouth and not be afraid to ask for that referral.
Yeah.
Plant that seed in the mind of your client and watch what happens.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I feel like, you know, there's so much talk about, you know, having that hustle mindset and like being upfront and pushing yourself into the industry. But I feel like when it comes to dealing with clients, a lot of people are struggling with, you know, what is the right etiquette? Like how do I interact with them properly outside of, you know, just asking them what they think of this or like what they have in mind for a project. So hopefully that's something that, you know, DeCircle is trying to help with by, you know, giving these resources to help people understand how to interact with clients and, you know, get yourself out there and build that referral chain that you were talking about. So, this is kind of going back to a later thing, earlier thing that we were talking about, but, you know, in terms of how you interact with clients and, you know, client experiences, you know, beyond just name recognition and prestige, who was the most memorable client that you ended up working with? And is there a story behind that?
Oh man, the most memorable client. I had so many great clients. We billed Disney more money than any other client, which I'm really proud of because that was a dream in life is, oh, someday I want to work with Disney. How many designers out there have that dream? So I was so grateful to have realized that dream. When we landed Google, that was a big deal because it was a, you know, Google, we ended up billing Google over $1 million in the last three years of my agency before I sold my agency. And so that was a really big deal. I think one of the most exciting ones was when we landed a project for Pepsi because it was the first major client to come to us that was not a word of mouth referral. They found us because of my agency's reputation. They were doing a search online. They found us. They looked at our work. They felt like we were the right fit for this project, and they reached out to us. And I think that was a big deal because now it wasn't the relationship game. It was the reputation game. And if you think the relationship game is valuable, man, the reputation game is even more valuable. When you can say, my name is Michael Beirut, and all of a sudden people will pay you $1 million because you're Michael Beirut and you're Pentagram and you've designed XYZ things over the last 30 years, people pay big for that. And so once you start getting found based on reputation, it unlocks super high value projects, high value opportunities, high value clients, but it takes a while to get to the reputation game. So most designers have to play the relationship game as their best way to generate work because it's few of us that get to play the reputation game. You think of names, you know, Draplin, for example, I love his work. He's built a brand around him and people will buy his logo design because it's a Draplin logo.
Yeah.
Amazing work. He's built a reputation and is able to leverage that to generate clients. If you're not Draplin and you haven't built that reputation, you got to play the relationship game.
Right.
Be friends, connect on a deeper level with your clients.
So for, in terms of the not just the relationship game, but the reputation game, what are metrics that you think clients typically look at to get a better understanding of your reputation? Because I know that on basically any website now, you can find testimonials and usually they're amazing. And you can like find that on their Instagrams too. So do you feel like reputation comes primarily from how big your audience is outside of just your portfolio work? Or does it come from a variety of other factors like awards, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned some of the major ones. So this is why design awards have value. This is why some agencies are bucking to be Ad Age Agency of the Year every year, and they're hoping to win it because they know it's going to have so much value to their business because it's going to bring this reputation to their business. So awards is a way, social media influence is a way that's super valuable for people. If you have a client, and let's talk about reputation game on a smaller level. If you have a client who's trying to decide between Ellen and Sally, and Ellen has an Instagram that has 200 posts and it's all great design and she has 4,000 followers, and Sally has an Instagram that has 3 posts and they're all of her cat and she has 10 followers and 5 of them are her family members, there's no validation in that. There's no reputation in the eyes of the client. So the client goes, they look at Instagram number 1 versus Instagram number 2, and they choose the one that has the perception of reputation. This is something that I think a lot of designers miss in building their audience, because they talk about, you'll see posts about this where people will say, oh, but I don't get any clients from Instagram. It's a waste of my time, that kind of stuff. But the truth is that if you have 6,000 followers on Instagram and a client looks at that, they may not have found you from Instagram, but it validates you and it builds your reputation in their perception, right, that could yield the work. So there is value in having that audience in the way that it builds your reputation. Reputation also is built through word of mouth referrals. I mean, that's a reputation game right there. If Joe tells Katie that Ellen is a great designer, then Katie all of a sudden has in her mind a reputation perception of Ellen that could yield work for Ellen. So it's part of that word of mouth. So I think awards, word of mouth, social media presence, all super valuable for building reputation.
Yeah. Have you found the same to be true in other platforms like LinkedIn? And how is that sort of, you know, do you think that Instagram is more valuable in terms of building that kind of audience, or have you gotten a lot of work from LinkedIn as well?
All social media, the way that it's done now is all pre or post the sale of my agency. I sold my agency in 2015. So the social media marketing component of finding design work wasn't there in 2015 the way that it is now. So for me, and I don't do client work anymore. Have a metric of my own. Any social channel that has a following can be valuable in building your reputation. It doesn't have to just be Instagram. The benefit to Instagram for a lot of designers is the diversity in content. You can post work in progress. You can post finished projects, you can post videos, you can post carousels of thought leadership. You have so many different types of content that can all go to influence your potential client to choose you because they watched a couple videos and they really liked you and they like your work and they get that validation through looking at your content. So I think Instagram is a great valuable platform. YouTube can be great. LinkedIn can be great. My recommendation is that you intentionally drive your potential client to the channel you want them to see. So if you're big and pushing your Instagram, then on your homepage of your website, where it says ellenyang.com, I don't know if that's your website. Here's the Hello Bird Box. Is that what it is?
It's Hello Brand Box, but yeah.
Hello Brand Box. Okay, sorry. So hellobrandbox.com, and they go on there and there is a, hey, follow me on Instagram for tips and tricks for how to manage your new brand identity. And they click and they go and see that you have 2,000 followers on Instagram. You drove them there. Don't make them go and find you. Drive them to what you want them to see. And then pick your channel and go for it. It can be LinkedIn if that's where you choose. It can be YouTube if that's where you choose. It can be Instagram, which is effective for a lot of designers.
Yeah, I think that's a really good tip, because I feel like, you know, even though like the whole point of being specialized in marketing is to understand how to like do call to actions and, you know, translate that to your design work, I think some people forget that, you know, they need to be more upfront about, you know, follow my social media. Don't just put it in the footer of your website and stuff like that. So that kind of relates to the community questions that we're going to explore now, because I think a lot of people are still struggling with that. So our first question is from Divyesh, who asks, how can an introvert start freelancing and meet real clients and start a conversation?
I had this question, similar question yesterday. Here's the deal with introverts. You have two choices. You can either get over your introversion and go out and find clients, or you can struggle in your business. It is hard to be an introvert and succeed as a freelancer. I mean, man, it's hard enough being an extrovert and to succeed as a freelancer. If you're an introvert, you've got to try and start figuring out how to get over it. I recommend the book all the time, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Dale Carnegie. It's a great book. Start reading that. Start practicing people skills. Force yourself out of your natural tendency to be introverted. Force yourself out of it and start getting out there and practicing these skills. It can be learned just like anybody else, just like any other skill. You can learn to be extroverted. I did. I mean, I was a shy kid growing up. I was shy. I was introverted. And I overcame that during high school and then especially in college. And then especially when I started to grow in my career, I had to overcome that. But it's still my natural tendency. I go into a room full of 200 people at a networking event and I have to suck it up and channel some super extrovert to go and start glad handing people. I gotta build up my confidence to do that. And I've been doing it a long time.
Yeah. I think it also helps to, you know, identify what kind of environment like makes you passionate to step out of that kind of introversion. Cause you know, when I was younger, I was also very introverted, but then, you know, like when I got into middle school and I was put in situations where I had to learn public speaking and networking. Mm-hmm. And then I like, you know, I had adopted this passion for business and stuff that definitely forced me to step out of that because I found a passion that I really wanted to succeed in. So I think for people who are struggling like Divyesh, it's just important to identify why you're here, why you want to do this, and then hopefully use that as a motivator to step out of whatever you're struggling with.
And it's real. I mean, some people really struggle with it for sure, and it's challenging. But I honestly, you really, really have to work to get over it because, like I said, freelancing and client interaction, building a freelance business, a successful business, that's hard for extroverts. You're going to have an even bigger challenge if you're an introvert because it is so relationship based. It's so communication based. So you got to really push yourself to overcome it.
Yeah. So I know that you just said that, you know, there is a way to learn how to step out of those natural tendencies. Our next question actually talks more about physical inhibitors, which prevent you from going out. So Sai wants to know, if he's a disabled person who's trying to be an independent designer, and he's finding it hard to go outside and socialize to find clients, among other problems, he wants to know, how can a disabled person manage to become an independent designer, and is it possible?
That's so interesting, the question, because a lot of us don't think about this because we don't have a disability that inhibits us this way. And when I saw this question, you sent me the notes before this talk, I thought about that and I thought, you know what? What a blessing for Sai that he's building his career in 2020 and not in 1995. Because in 1995, there was no option for him. But in 2020 and beyond, we have social media, we have Zoom calls, conference calls, podcast calls. We can reach out to our clients and FaceTime. We can share our journey in social media. My journey as a handicapped designer trying to be an independent freelancer and build relationships, well, that's a story that's interesting to a lot of people. So share your journey and build a reputation around that. I think that there's huge opportunities to leverage that as a strength, and technology has made it possible to still be successful in that situation today, whereas 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there would have been no choice. There would have been no chance to make that happen. So yeah. Those are my thoughts on that. I mean, there's no question it's a challenge, mm-hmm. but I think that you can figure out ways to make it a unique value that you bring to a client relationship. There's definitely something unique and memorable if you brand yourself right. Okay. Yeah. Those are my thoughts.
I think you make a really great point, because I think just in general, like, the reason why design has thrived so much on social media, and, you know, we've been able to see all this inspiration and introduce diverse members to the community, is because technology just gives us a lot more tools. And we sort of talked about this earlier on, you know, when you look just even beyond the generational differences and, like, you know, the things that are available to younger people now that weren't necessarily available, you know, the generation before that. It does help a lot that we are living in 2020, and not only do we have these tools, but the community itself is a lot more accepting. And I think clients are a lot more accepting because they are prioritizing, you know, your portfolio and your reputation and everything else before a lot of the social things that used to stop a lot of people from pursuing stuff like this.
Yeah. You know, something that I was thinking here when we're recording this right now, we're in the quarantine era of coronavirus, and everybody has the same limitation that Cy mentioned in his question. We're all in the same limitation. We're all limited to be able to go outside. We're all limited to be able to socialize and find clients in the old traditional ways. So we all have to figure out how to adapt right now that same way. We got to figure out, how do we connect with people when we can't go to a networking event and connect with them? How do you build a relationship with somebody when you can't go and take them to lunch and spend an hour being buddies with them? How do you do it? And the answer is, you got to use the technology and start to get experimental. And don't be afraid to set up Zoom calls with your clients. And don't be afraid to turn on your Instagram Live. I saw a friend of mine do this, a friend of mine from Moscow. Turned on his Instagram Live while he was working, and it was just sitting there. And I jumped in and I was like, "Hey man, how are you doing?" And he was like, "Oh, I'm good. I'm just turning this on just if anybody wants to pop in and say hi." He was turning on like this virtual voyeur window into his workspace. And I thought, you know, that's an interesting way to be able to reconnect with people who don't want to just pop by. I think Facebook is doing this with their messaging tool, this ability to have a room where people can just come by. And I think that's the start of leveling the playing field through technology. Yeah. It levels the playing field for people like Cy, who are struggling with a unique challenge. Well, there's technology being created that will be massively beneficial to him and his ability to still connect with clients without being able to go outside and do that physically as easily as other people.
Yeah, I think that the age of the coronavirus has definitely, it's not only just, you know, affecting how a lot of people are working on freelance now, and, you know, how people are, the economic concerns a lot of people have, but I mean, on the flip side, even though with all the, you know, disease and death and economic impacts, like, there's a ton of really positive, you know, technology first work that's being done that's really helping, you know, ease people's minds and also just make it easier for them to do work like that. So I think that it's a really good point you brought up, and hopefully a lot of people feel a lot better after listening.
Good. Hopefully so. That's the goal.
Yes. So sort of related to coronavirus, Rushal wants to know, how do you price your work and how do you assess your value as a designer, you know, considering all the economic impacts right now? And how do you actually know how much to charge and change your pricing without that fear of losing a client or being turned down or, you know, having some kind of bad blood start?
Oh man, that's such a big question. That's the crux of my book, The Psychology of Graphic Design Pricing. It's 200 pages is my answer to that. I also have a module for my course coming up, which is like 28 lessons that relate to pricing alone. My course is over 100 lessons, but the pricing module alone is like 28 lessons. So that's a big, big question. The short answer is know your profitable amount. Know where you're going to break even on a project and price it above that. And when we're in coronavirus and you're afraid because you don't have very much work right now, you don't want to do something unprofitably, but you can drop your rates to land a client, because last year they would have spent $3,000 and this year their budgets are tapped because their economy of their business is struggling because of lockdown, shutdown, quarantine implications. Now they'll only spend $1,500. Well, last year, maybe this project costs you $800 to make it, and $1,500 represents a $700 profit, whereas last year it's $800 to make it, and you could have charged $3,000 and you could have made $2,200. Well, my opinion is you're still making $700. Mm-hmm. And if the budgets are going down and you can still be profitable, then that's how you survive a recession. That's how you survive an economic hit, is by staying profitable even when the budgets are reduced. So understand your cost to produce the work, and then don't be afraid to drop your rate to land the work if the client's budget doesn't accommodate the bigger budget they used to have, which is the reality of an economic downturn. People start slashing their budgets. You got to decide if you're going to take that or not.
Yeah. So let's say that, you know, someone, so let's say that Rushal slashes his budget now. He takes his prices down a notch because he wants to find more clients. So, you know, after quarantine and after this whole pandemic and, you know, hopefully after all the negative effects that are going to come after, you know, the disease is actually done, how does he actually take his price from this time and bring it up in a way that doesn't, I guess, scare off his clients or anything?
So I don't recommend setting a price for yourself. I recommend pricing each project independently. And so let's say you do logo design. I don't recommend advertising that your logos are $1,000. You do a $1,000 logo package and it is XYZ, and that's what you charge every client. My recommendation is that a client comes to you and you talk with them about the scope of their project and their needs, and then you ask them, what is the budget that you hope to spend to accomplish these goals that you have for this project? And then you let them say to you, oh, you know what, we have about $1,000. And then you decide if you want to take it for $1,000 or not. And I don't recommend that you take it unless you're making money on it. So you got to know that your cost to produce it is less than $1,000. Now, how does it trickle back up when things turn around? Well, that's going to happen naturally, because if you sit with a client today and you say, here's the scope, what are your goals and what's your budget to accomplish those goals? And they say 1,000. 2 years from now, they may be looking at it saying, you know what, our budget's $3,000 for this, because they've increased their budgets because the economy is better. But some things don't turn around. If I go back to 2008, what happened in 2008, the economic downturn, there was a big recession. My billings got cut in half from 2008 to 2009. We started dropping our prices on what we would accept from a client. So pre 2009 or pre-recession, we might have been charging $20,000, $30,000 for a website. In the recession era, brochure websites all of a sudden became $3,000 jobs, $5,000 jobs, maybe a $10,000 job. Some of these brochure websites went away. And then some of these tools like Squarespace started to emerge, and people had a good quality do-it-yourself tool. And the prices never came back for brochure sites. All of a sudden, you were either going to do it for $3,000 to $5,000, or you were going to use Squarespace for that because these tools emerged. So sometimes prices, the point of this is that sometimes prices don't come back after things downturn, but other times they do. Other times, all of a sudden, big budgets started happening again. We started landing big enterprise websites when it came to 2011, 2012. We started doing a lot of six-figure website projects, you know, $100,000, $300,000 jobs. We did $500,000 job in 2000, where our business went because the little projects that we used to sustain ourselves on went away.
Yeah, I think that's interesting to look back and see, you know, how things are changing. I think that there are a lot of tools now, you know, like WordPress, you know.
Yeah.
I think a few years ago, it might have cost a lot more to hire someone to make you a WordPress website. But nowadays, like, it's most people would rather just, you know, learn it themselves than pay that extra $1,000 to get someone to do it for them. So,
right.
I mean, I guess it's good to look back and try to identify those trends to make sure that you're able to, you know, be able to price yourself. But I also see a lot of stuff online about, you know, where people want you to, or they recommend that you place yourself as a high-end designer. So how do you really get from, you know, working with your first client to kind of prioritizing yourself as a high-end client? And do you think you lose a lot of value while trying to take that step into being, you know, self-priced, even if you're trying, if, like, I think people are doing it mostly to find, like, luxury clients. Do you think that approach of, you know, still waiting for their budget still works in that kind of situation? And do you think that it is something that can be very successful for a lot of agencies?
Well, each agency can position themselves appropriate to the market. And what you're looking for when you're positioning yourself in the market is you're trying to find the land of opportunity for you. And it's not always high-priced clients with high-quality design. There are a lot of people that make great money with high-quality design for a lower price, or they make great money with average quality design for a lower price. There are different quadrants in market positioning, which is a business strategy, a business technique, where you take a spectrum of two criteria. So let's say quality is one of your criteria and price is another criteria. Well, you run high quality and low price on one axis, and you run you run high quality and low quality on one axis and high price and low price on another axis. And that gives you four quadrants. And you can look at it and say, okay, where am I going to play? Am I going to be high quality, high price? Or am I going to be high quality and I'm going to be lower price? I'm going to undercut the higher priced people. Or am I going to be average quality with a lower price? You got to determine where you want to play, because business can be built in any of those quadrants. There are a lot of people that make a ton of money in a low quality, low price solution. Take cell phones, for example. The cell phone market. Almost everybody has a cell phone, but not everybody has an iPhone Pro Max that came out last year. Not everybody decides that they want to spend $1,200 or $1,500 on their cell phone. Many people are content to have the $200 or $300 mobile phone that does enough for them. Yes, it's a lower quality solution. Yes, it's a cheaper solution, but it's still satisfactory of a choice for a lot of people. So where do you want to be? Because you can make a great business selling the lower quality product for a lower price and doing more projects, or you can decide, I want to be premium and I'm going to be high quality and high price and I'm going to go after high quality projects. And I think this is a problem that a lot of designers have. They look at this and they think, my only chance at having a good career is if someday I get that big award and I land that huge client and that's when I'll be successful. But man, go look around the landscape. There are a lot of designers out there that are killing it in a fast turnaround, good quality, but a cheaper price thing. And they're just cranking projects. Yeah. So you got to decide what you want. And it doesn't always have to be high quality, high price. I think that's the summary of that statement.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make, because I think no matter what industry you're working in, when it comes to freelancing, you know, figuring out how you want to position yourself and what your selling point really is super important. And I think that's something that some people struggle with. They take it to the extreme, because I know personally when I was starting out, I started my agency when I was really young. I think I was only 15 actually. And
good,
I got
really
excited when I got my first, like, it was like one client and then two clients and three clients. And then I was like, look at me, like I'm charging websites for $99 and I'm so happy about it. Cause like I'm 14 and making money. But then, you know, like after a while, I think that you realize, wait, I don't know if I want to just be, you know, the cheapest option on the market, because I want to, you know, make more money and, you know, value myself as a business person. So I think that a lot of people, when they get started freelancing, you know, because they know that if they were shopping, they would want the cheapest option, but they forget, you know, people's perceived quality also comes from how you price yourself, I feel like.
Yeah. And not everybody's shopping for the cheapest option. That's just one of these purchase criteria that people have. Some people are shopping for the cheapest price, and that's what they're going to buy. And if you're a dollar more, they're going to go with the other option because you cost $1 more. They're price shopping. But other people are shopping for quality. They're shopping for the return on investment. And if they believe that Ellen can give me a better return on investment than John, then I'm going to choose Ellen, because even though she costs more, I'm going to choose her because I'm shopping for return on investment, not price. Yeah. And then relationship is one of the things. Some people will choose you as a purchase criteria of relationship because they like you. You're their friend. They want to work with you. They want to give you the money. They're like, I have this budget. I might as well use Ellen because she's my friend. I'd rather have her get the $3,000 from my budget than somebody I don't even know. So relationship is another purchase criteria. So I think that when we look at that kind of spectrum, not everybody's price shopping. And some designers are working with a lot of price shopping clients. They're working with the client who is, if somebody is charging $60 for a logo and the other person's $50, then they're going to buy the $50 one. That is going to be a challenging business, but you still can make that business successful if you embrace the fact that your business is $50 logos. And if your business is $50 logos, how do you turn that into a profitable business? Well, I've got to automate some things. I've got to create some kind of a tool where it's plug and play. The client chooses an icon. I change the text. I send them the files. And it's some kind of quick turn thing that you can figure out how to do in 10 minutes. And yes, you can make a business on $50 logos. Most designers don't want that and don't want to be in that business because we esteem ourselves as creative people. We love to do the design work. But the point I'm trying to make is that there is still a way to make money even with the price shoppers that are out there. You just have to change the dynamics of your business to adapt to that market position.
Yeah, I think that example is pretty good, you know, where you're talking about price shoppers and how I think just every business, like when they're looking into hiring a third party to manage stuff like that, and, you know, to do marketing or to do design or whatever, you know, every business comes in with different things. And I guess it's really just up to you to decide what kind of client base you want to build and what's important to you as a business and just stuff like that. And hopefully you'll be able to build kind of strong client base based off things that, you know, both satisfy what you need for your wallet and also for your own ideals of what you want your business to be.
Yeah. So, can I make a comment on that?
Yeah.
The relationship game is the right one to play for most people.
Yeah.
It is going back to what we were talking about a little earlier. It's not to market yourself as the price option. It's not even to market yourself as the quality option. It's to market yourself as a relationship option, to go and build these authentic, real relationships with your clients where they trust you, They like you and they choose you because you're great to work with and they like to work with you. That's what it is. And you have to produce a quality that is sufficient to yield the results that they need. But outside of that level, you don't have to have it be an award-winning design every time to make a great business with good budgets if you're playing the relationship game. So definitely, I'm not encouraging anybody to play the price game because it is one of the most challenging ones to play. There was a business near me called Logo Works back in the day, and they were doing the $100 logo thing. They built an automated tool that allowed people to create a logo really fast and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, and they hired a bunch of designers to make a bunch of templated logos and things. And so a client could go on there and create their own logo and get the files that they needed. And that business sold to Hewlett Packard for $150 million. So that was a low price solution. It was for the price shoppers and it sold for a big, big acquisition to a major company. Yeah. So this is an example. My point of kind of going down this road in this conversation is to say, you got to decide what kind of business you want to be and then position yourself intentionally in the marketplace.
Do you feel like there's a certain way to establish yourself as that? Because I think like when you are doing the $50 logos, it's super easy to be like, we're the most affordable option. You're not going to find a price cheaper than us. But how do you do that when you're trying to focus more on like, oh, this is like, we're doing this ourselves. Like we are trying to provide you quality. Does it get repetitive when everyone's like, oh no, we're all, you know, providing quality. So how do you really like showcase that and bring that to the forefront when you're, you know, introducing yourself to clients and making sure that they understand who you are and what you prioritize in business?
So, you know, what the answer to that is, you got to identify what your unique value proposition is. What is it that you bring to the table? There are two questions in sales. One is, why should the client buy the thing you're selling? And the other one is, why should they buy it from you? So Ellen designs logos. I keep using you as every example. So hopefully you get a lot of good brand awareness out of this podcast. So Ellen designs great logos. The client comes to you. They know they need a logo. But why should they buy the logo for you from you rather than from Joe? Why should they buy it from you? What's your answer to that? You have to know that about yourself. And if you say, oh, well, we provide good quality. Well, so does Joe. Well, if you say, well, we can turn it around in a good time frame. Well, so can Joe. What makes you different? It has to be something like this. It has to be, well, you're a pizza restaurant. And I've done 17 pizza restaurants in the past, and my mom owns a pizza restaurant, and I know everything about the pizza industry, and you're a pizza restaurant, and I'm a logo designer. Now, all of a sudden, you've differentiated yourself from the rest. You've created a unique value that you bring to the table in comparison to Joe, who's just a logo designer. Now, the client may choose you for more money because you bring something unique to the table. So you've got to try and identify for yourself, what is my unique value proposition? What am I even doing here? Why should somebody choose me over the next person? And it helps if you're identifying a niche. If you can become the expert in a certain industry, you can become an expert in a certain piece of technology, you can bring some kind of unique knowledge to the table that sets you apart from the competitors. And that's what I'd say to all the price shoppers. You don't want to play that game against all the Fiverr logos out there that are throwing up a bunch of logos for a client to choose from, and it's $15. You don't want to be that. So how do you differentiate yourself from that? Well, you sit with the client or have a video call with the client and say, you know what? Yes, we're not the cheapest option out there. But what we're going to bring to the table is we're going to take you through our brand strategy process. We're going to do some personas where you want to really understand your audience. Who are you trying to reach with your new brand identity? And then we're going to do some research. We're going to call a couple of your customers. We're going to research those customers, and then we're going to run these logo designs past those customers. When we design these things, we're going to get real feedback from your real customers. Now, all of a sudden, you're not a Fiverr logo designer anymore. Now you're a brand identity designer that brings in a measure of brand strategy into the engagement, and now you've differentiated yourself from all the price shopping Fiverr designers that exist out there. So this is the answer. This is a long-winded answer to say unique value proposition. Mm-hmm. Why should they choose you over somebody else?
Yeah. Hopefully that helps a lot of people who are listening, because I think that another issue that's facing the design community is that people are starting to, you know, both people who are outside of this community and, you know, are just following these accounts, people are starting to realize the repetitiveness in some accounts and how, you know, a lot of accounts seem very similar in the kind of value they're trying to offer. And the same applies to agencies. So hopefully, you know, trying to find your unique value point and use that and implement that proudly and show that on your website and your social media. Hopefully that will help a lot of people.
And you know what is the most unique thing about Ellen? It's Ellen. No, the most unique thing about Mike is Mike. Yeah. This is the thing. Everybody has a unique value proposition in this relationship game that we've talked about. You're unique. You will be able to connect with somebody else in a unique way that is only between you and them. It's a special, unique relationship. You have a unique personality in comparison to everybody else in the entire world. You are unique. And so some of the answer to this is just be yourself. Build a real relationship, and your unique value proposition is work with me because I'm a good designer. And hey, I'm Mike, your buddy. We're friends. We have a relationship. That is the ultimate unique value proposition that you can bring to the table. Right. Is just your own unique self.
Yeah. I think that's a good, really good point to make, because I think, you know, I definitely was struggling with this when I was rebranding my account, because, you know, I saw accounts like yours and, like, you know, there's like so many other marketing UI UX related accounts out there, and like they're doing stuff like carousels, and you know they're all doing the same look and everything, and you know when you're joining and entering this community, you feel like you have to emulate that same look and like you know, be like them, use all those carousels and do exactly what they're doing. But then in that process you kind of lose the value that you bring to the community, which is that you're unique, you're someone new, you're here to do your thing. So it's hard to figure out, you know, how do I balance traditional success here and, you know, things that have worked for other account owners of mine while not losing that part of myself that makes me so different and appealing to clients.
Yeah. I think, you know, the answer is in being authentic. If you look at my account, I share a whole wide variety of different types of content. And sometimes it's just a fun, joking, play around piece of content. And sometimes it's knowledge bombs, and sometimes it's video stuff, and sometimes it's carousels. It's diversity in content, but I don't research anybody else's accounts to decide what my content's going to be. I just use inspiration from conversations like this. I probably have 5 carousel ideas that could come out of this conversation that inspire me to know what should I make next. And then I do it in my own unique, flavorful, fun way. And if people don't like it, so be it. If they don't want to follow me, so be it. I'm not going to be a connection for everybody in the world. And I'm not looking to. Nobody likes everybody. Some people won't like me. Some people won't like you. That's okay, because you're looking for the ones who do. So be your authentic self. Be you. Share your own unique ideas and let the people who are like-minded find you and follow you and connect with you. That's who you're trying to find.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think especially because my agency now is focused more on Gen Z, and you know, as a Gen Zer, I understand and I've seen a lot of research for how important being authentic is online now, because you know, the new generation of consumers isn't the generation that cares about how many followers you have on Instagram, unless they're real and they're engaging with you and you have a feed that they actually want to follow you for. So, you know, I think now is the best time to really focus on being more authentic. Just like cutting a lot of that fluffy stuff that doesn't actually feel real and, you know, gives you the kind of connections and builds those relationships that we were talking about, to really get you from point A to point B and in a place where you actually want to be in the future. So yeah. I guess we've answered this final question in a million ways already on this podcast, but what is the key piece of advice that you would give yourself back in 2002, as a new entrepreneur, and what should listeners really take away from this podcast episode today?
Oh man. Okay. Well, so what they should really take away is the Mike Janda mantra of relationships are everything. And I've said it so many times. Right. So because we hammered on that so hard, I'm going to give you something different for this answer. And it is be intentional. Be intentional in what you're doing. This is the advice I would have given myself back in 2002. In 2002, I started freelancing out of fear, out of necessity, not on purpose, not intentionally. It took me 2-3 years before I decided, you know what? I'm going to turn this into an agency. I'm going to go for this. Look at me go. And I was billing $700,000 a year, and I had like 5 employees before I even decided that this is going to be something bigger than what I'm doing right now. So be intentional. Choose what you want to do and then go after it. That's the advice I would give myself in 2002. And I think I would couple that with, don't worry so much if it doesn't work out. If it doesn't work out, man, you got a long career ahead of you. You don't have to worry so much that if it doesn't work out, then what are you going to do? Well, you're going to figure it out. You're going to figure it out. Everybody figures it out. That's what we're doing all our career until the day we retire or die. We're just figuring it out. And don't be afraid to just dig in there and figure it out and look back on the last 20 years of your life, and you're going to see an amazing journey that you've accomplished.
Yeah. I think that's some really good advice that is kind of glossed over sometimes in this community, because there's just so much focus on hustle and being at the top of the game that you kind of lose that sense of what actually gets you to the top of the game, which is, you know, everything we've talked about in this episode, which is just relationship building, you know, knowing your own value and understanding what makes you unique and helps you contribute to not just your community, but also just, you know, your clients. What can they gain from working with you that they can't from anyone else? And that comes back to everything that we've been able to talk about today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that that brings us to the end of today's episode. This was an amazing conversation. I feel so blessed to be able to have talked to you
about this. Oh, I loved it. So fun.
And I know that all of our listeners will be super grateful that we got to feature you on our new podcast. So it's been really fun and really thankful that we got to, you know, make this happen so fast and sit down and have this conversation.
So fun. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
So what social medias and any new, I guess, plugs for your course and everything, what should people go to when they want to learn more about you or, you know, talk to you more about anything that we've talked about here today?
Follow me on Instagram at morejanda. I reply to every DM. I spend 2 or 3 hours every day replying to direct messages. Try and keep it brief. If you ask me a question, don't ask me a question like, how do I become a freelancer? Because that answer is a 50-hour answer. But if you keep it brief, I'll answer your questions for sure. And I always love to connect with people. And you hopefully have seen that, Ellen, when we started chatting. I just love that, man. That is the thing I didn't know when I started my Instagram journey was how much joy that would bring me in life was getting these new relationships with people all over the world. It's the greatest thing in my life. And so don't hesitate to reach out to me if you want to. That's the message for all the people out there listening. Happy to connect. And then my website's michaeljanda.com. You can find out more about my course and other things there. There's an email sign up if you want to get an announcement for that. And I'll be blasting my stuff on social too.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. So once again, I'm Ellen Yang, the host of the Designer's Inner Circle, and we'll see you here again back next week.